Introduction and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O son of Bhrigu, Shanaka, when the child Parikshit, the great fighter, was in the womb of his mother Uttara and was suffering from the burning heat of the Brahmastra thrown by Aswatthama, he could observe the Supreme Lord coming to him. Purport. Death generally involves remaining in trance for 7 months. A living being, according to his own action, is allowed to enter into the womb of a mother by the vehicle of a father's semina, and thus he develops his desired body. This is the law of birth in specific bodies according to one's past actions. When he is awake from trance, he feels the inconvenience of being confined within the womb, and thus he wants to come out of it, and sometimes fortunately prays to the Lord for such liberation. Maharaj Parikshit, while in the womb of his mother, was struck by the Brahmastra released by Aswatthama, and he was feeling the burning heat. But because he was a devotee of the Lord at once appeared himself within the womb by his all-powerful energy. And the child could see that someone else had come to save him. Even in that helpless condition, the child Parikshit endured the unbearable temperature due to his being a great fighter by nature. And for this reason, the word viraha has been used. Matur garbha gato vira satadha bhrigunandana siddharsha purusam kanchid dhyamano stratejasa. O son of Bhrigu, Shanaka, when the child Parikshit, the great fighter, was in the womb of his mother Uttara and was suffering from the burning heat of the Brahmastra thrown by Ashvatthama, he could observe the Supreme Lord coming to him. Here is described something of the process of death and rebirth. Now, this is one of the main questions that any religion or philosophy should answer. If you go to most of the religions in the world today, most of the religious leaders and guide, and you ask them, what is the process of death and rebirth? What is the process of death? What is the meaning of death? Why is there death? What happens at death? You get a lot of vague answers because there is not clarity in their own scriptures. So just like, we don't want to pick on them, but just like for, as an example, so I'm sure that in most parts of the world, we have the Jehovah's Witnesses come to the door. And they have a philosophy that when you die, your body is, you are the body, and you just stay in the ground, I guess in some sort of a suspended state. And then at some point, all the bodies will come out of the ground, and then we'll have a heaven on earth. So that's their philosophy. However, this is not coming from their own scriptures. Or let's say it's really based very loosely on their scriptures. So they take one or two statements from the scriptures and they concoct something. They just make something up. And the way you can tell that it's made up is if you start asking a lot of questions, which they don't really appreciate, they don't have any answer for it. So you say, okay, well, when I come out of the ground, how old am I going to be? You know, suppose I died when I was 98. And I was all wrinkled and arthritic. And, you know, do I come out of the ground at 98? Or do I come out of the ground at the age of 20 or 5? Or, you know, how does that work? And then I say, well, suppose also you were really ugly. You know, and you didn't like your nose or something like that. Do you come out with a defective body? Oh, no. Everything will be fine, you know. But they don't really have anything authoritative. Whereas in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives a general description of the process, especially in chapter 13 and 15, especially 13. Krishna gives a general description, also in chapter 8, of the process of death and rebirth. What happens at the time of death? How is it decided where we're reborn, etc.? This is then explained in detail in the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam by Lord Kapila Dev. And then it's explained in summary form in many places in the scripture. It's explained, say, with the story of Paranjana and many, many other places. I know one devotee who compiled a list of how reincarnation is explained in the Bhagavad Gita in a general way with specifics, you know, in many different ways. You can call the list of verses. So here Srila Prabhupada is giving us something that's authoritative. Now, I should say that what he's saying in this purport is not the whole story. It's part of the story. He's saying death involves generally, first of all, he uses the word generally, that death generally involves remaining in trance for 7 months. So in other words, the first 7 months, lunar months this is, seven times 28, 29 days that you are in the womb of your mother, we're in a state of deep sleep, a state of trance. And after that, the child awakens, so it's just the last section of time in the womb in which the child is fully conscious. By the way, that does not justify abortion. Killing somebody in deep sleep, it doesn't make it okay. And I'm sure the act of killing somebody rouses them from deep sleep. There's been a lot of indication when people do sonograms during abortions that the child is in great distress, even if it's a very small, even if the body is very, very small. So even if the body that we're in is very small and undeveloped, it doesn't mean that killing is appropriate. You know, I mean, even if I knock you totally unconscious, you know, if I give you anesthesia first and you're unconscious and then kill you, that doesn't mean that killing you is very nice just because you don't feel pain upon being killed. But here that's not indicated. So even if you're in trance, if somebody starts cutting you up into little pieces, I'd say there's a good chance that you'd wake up and feel that that is happening. Of course, nowadays, abortion has become very common for not just for some emergency, but just whimsically. Oh, well, I already have two girls. I don't want a third girl. Let me kill this child. Or what's happening now, at least in America, is if people are having twins, oh, it would be too much trouble to take care of twins, so kill one of them. This kind of thing is going on. So we're not saying that the child is in trance for 7 months doesn't mean that you can't harm them. But anyway, this in trance for 7 months in the womb, before that, one generally, as explained in the third canto, is taken by the agents of Yamaraj. So generally, one goes through the court of Yamaraj if one has performed any sinful activities, and who can say that they perform no sinful activities? I mean, even King Nriga, who was such a pious, unbelievably pious person, he also went to the court of Yamaraj. Of course, who takes you there may differ, just like we have the story with Ajamila, where he's pulled out of his body by the very fierce-looking Yamadutas. We have in the story mentioned in the Mahabharata of Savitri and Satyavan, where Satyavan was taken out of his body by Yamaraj himself. So Yamaraj has different kinds of agents, different levels of agents, and he also may come himself, but somebody will come to take us out of the body. Now, sometimes what happens also is the person doesn't go on to the next body. This is described also in the story of the king who died on the battle that Hiranyakashipu tells, that if the body is not cremated, if there are not proper funeral ceremonies for the body soon after death, then the soul may be so attached that it doesn't leave and it becomes a ghost. So there can be different circumstances if a person dies when they're very intoxicated, for example, where somehow they get stuck. Something like if you're in an elevator that gets stuck between floors. So sometimes the soul inside of the subtle body gets stuck and stays attached to the former body and won't move on. I mean, even in this life, we sometimes experience that where it's time to move on. It's time to make a change in our life, and we're just so attached to the way things have been and what we have or whatever that we just don't want to make that choice. We don't want to take that next step. So sometimes this happens at the time of death. So anyway, at the time of death, generally, unless one hovers as a ghost, one goes in front of Yamaraj, and Yamaraj debates your case. He looks at the list of one's activities kept by his scribes, Chitragupta. And he looks at this according to desires also, as Prabhupada is saying here in this purport. It says, thus he develops his desired body. So we're Yamaraj is deciding, he's understanding what is the nature of our desires. And he's understanding that by our behaviors. We demonstrate what we desire by what we do. We demonstrate our desires by what we do. And therefore, this law of karma, as Prabhupada also says here, according to one, he says this is the law of birth in specific bodies according to one's past actions. So there's two things going on here, one's desires and one's actions, but they're very interrelated. So if I park my car illegally, in one sense, I don't desire to get a parking ticket, but in another sense, what I'm saying is that what I want to do in this place is so important that I'm willing to risk getting a parking ticket. So that's one way of saying it's not that I'm out and out desiring, but it's implied. It's implied. And of course, this also relates to the golden rule, how you treat others relates to how you're treated. Yesterday, unfortunately, I was ended up having a phone call with somebody who dealt with me in a way that was very disturbing. I was trying to work on something. I said, okay, we're having this and this and this problem. And the other person's response was just, well, I just don't understand why you're having that kind of problem. Just tolerate it, and I'm not interested in what you have to say. It was very unsettling and disturbing. When I got off the phone, I was really meditating that I have to make sure that my own dealings with other people are always respectful. So the law of karma is also like that. What I desire, as shown by my actions. So if I desire to have people treat me in a considerate way, then I need to also treat others in a considerate way. Because if I'm inconsiderate and disrespectful to others, that's also indicative of my desires, strangely enough. I mean, most of us want to be treated nicely, but if we are ill-treating others on a regular basis, then can we really say we want to live in an atmosphere of being well-treated? I mean, I have one person I know where this person is regularly writing things that are insulting and criticizing others, and then when this person is himself criticized, he becomes very surprised. So what the kind of atmosphere that we desire is the one that we're creating. It's just like, you know, I'm here in my office, and I just got 20 boxes of books and files that had been in storage since 2005. You know, and I have to think about, okay, what kind of furniture do I want to get to put them in? Do I want to get the cheap press board from Walmart for $30? Do I want to get the plywood from Target for $150? Do I want to get just real wood from, what's that store, Augusta, for $130? You know, so I'm deciding, okay, what kind of sacrifice am I able or willing to make myself in order to create the kind of atmosphere that I want to live in? Hey, does this make sense? So I look at what I have. I say, okay, what resources has Krishna given me? And how do I want to use those resources in order to create the atmosphere that I want to live in? And then I live with it. You know, if I say, well, I really don't want to spend money on bookcases, let me just get a couple of cheapos, you know, then that's what you live with. Think, okay, well, the money would be better. Krishna would be happier if I spent the money on something else. Or do I look at it and say, well, these are all Bhagavatam and Krishna books. Maybe I should get a really nice bookcase for them. So these are the sort of decisions we're all making in our life. Each of us is coming into this life with a certain amount of credit, pious credit, a certain amount of Shakti, and a certain kind of Shakti also. It's like there's these personality studies. They can tell you what kind of Shakti do you have? You know, we were looking at this from Paramahamsa, right? And he looks at 16 personality types. So one is very responsible. One is very loyal or contemplative, independent, conceptual, idealistic, artistic, pragmatic, spontaneous, generous, optimistic, inventive, charging, hard charging, harmonizing, persuasive, and commanding. So we have this sort of nature and this sort of talents we're bringing with us, something like we have a certain amount of money in the bank. So we have a certain amount of Shakti and a certain kind of Shakti, and then we have to decide, how am I going to spend that to create the kind of atmosphere in which I want to live? How am I going to spend the Shakti, the amount of Shakti, and the kind of Shakti that I'm walking into this life with because of my past actions, because of my past desires? So if I'm a very artistic person in this life, that's indicative of what I worked for in a previous life. Or if I'm very optimistic or very generous, whatever it may be. So, okay, now that's what I've got. I've got a certain amount of Shakti and a certain kind. And the way in which I choose to use it creates an atmosphere that I'm living in. So if I'm very cruel and inconsiderate to others, I will be living in a cruel, inconsiderate environment. If I'm very charitable, then I will be living in an environment of charity and opulence. Prabhupada says directly that how much money we have in this life is due, it's directly due to how charitable we were in our previous life. And that is even true to a large extent in this life. So I can adjust the atmosphere I live in even in this life. If I choose to use my Shakti in a way that's pleasing to Krishna, then I'm going to be in an atmosphere in this life where Krishna's pleased. I'm creating my own reality. Therefore, we have this combination, as Prabhupada says here, of desire and action. Desire and action. So my desire is exemplified in my action. When I was studying at the university, I had to do a detailed project on school budgets. And one point that was made to me over and over again by the financial leaders in different school districts is that you can judge the actual priorities of a school district by how they spend their money. Now, people can say, this is really what's important to me, this is what's really important to me, this is what's really important to me. But you know what's really important by how you spend your money. And I would say it's not just money, it's our energy. Where do we spend our energy? Not just what are we doing, how are we doing it, with what mood? So this is what's determining what atmosphere we're living in right now. Nobody is constructing our life right now except for myself. I'm constructing it from what I do now and what I've done in the past. And I'm also constructing my future. Right? The room I build today is the room I'm going to be living in for a while. The way I develop relationships now is the way my relationships are going to be developing. So this is the understanding of the process of death. And why death? Death is there because one cannot get all of one's desires fulfilled in one body. If I have desires to do things that this body doesn't accommodate, I have to get a different body. A material body is only able to accommodate certain things. I remember seeing a billboard in London advertising blue jeans, and it showed a tiger drinking from a stream. And right next to the tiger was a literally half-naked woman wearing these blue jeans, also drinking from the stream. You know, it said something like, buy these jeans and release your wild side or something like that. So if you want to be wild like an animal, it doesn't work very well if you have human consciousness. You know, it's really kind of inconvenient. Just like in modern society, they want to have unrestricted sex. They don't want to have sex according to moral code. But then they have all these problems with guilt and emotional attachments. And it kind of gets in the way, you know. They think, okay, well, we'll just have this casual sexual encounters, and then they get attached, right? It just doesn't work. So if you want to live like that, then you have to lose your human consciousness. You have to be an animal. Of course, the animal sex life is tightly controlled by their nature. So even they can't just live like that, I suppose, unless you have the nature of a monkey or a pigeon. But my point is that our different desires are going to get us different bodies, and they're incompatible desires. You know, I want to fly, then I'm a bird. I want to, Prabhupada said, you want to go surfing, then you become a fish. You want everyone to admire your naked beauty, you become a tree. So for this reason, there's death and rebirth, and there's forgetfulness. So this is the basic science, and for the materialistic person, the process of death and rebirth is not very much fun. It's sort of, you know, even in this life, the process of uprooting yourself and reestablishing yourself someplace else, it's difficult. You know, you've gotten to know a place, you know where all the stores are, you know where all the roads are, you've created friendships and connection and community, you've gotten really good at your job. And even if you want to move on, and even if it's time to move on, it's not so easy. Uprooting all of your attachments, right, packing everything, moving to a new place, unpacking, getting to know new people, getting to know your way around. And so death and rebirth is also like that. You leave behind all of your stuff. You even leave behind your body. You leave behind your family. You leave behind everything except your subtle body, which you take with you from life to life. And, of course, although it's time to move on, you may not be willing. The Yamadutas have to pull you with rope. Come on, let's go to your new situation. Then you've got to go to court and discuss the whole thing. If you're really sinful, as explained in the third canto and in the fifth canto, then you have a little side trip to the hellish planet. Right? That's, you know, if you've done really nasty things, if you've eaten animals alive, if you've cheated innocent people, if you're a Brahmin who's taken intoxication, if you've engaged in illicit sexual activities, so then there's all sorts of hellish punishments that you go through to try to reform your subtle body before you're put into the next body. And then, depending on one's desires and activities, one is put into a corresponding body, anywhere from the body of Lord Brahma down to a little germ. Yasvin Vigopa Matavendra Mahoswakarma Bandhan Rupa Palabha Janam Atinoti. So this is the cycle of karma. And if you're put into a body lower than human being, then you have to work your way step by step by step by step by step back up into the human body. And when you're in the human womb for 7 lunar months, you're in trance, then you come to consciousness in this dark, hot place, right, in water, where you're getting both your air and your food through the umbilical cord, where you may have itching sensations that you can't scratch. And altogether, it's a very difficult situation wherein the fortunate soul remembers his previous 100 births and prays to the Lord for deliverance. But in the process of birth and coming into a new family, often forgets. Just like we may say, well, starting tomorrow, I'm going to read a chapter of the Bhagavad Gita every day, and I'm just going to surrender to Krishna. And then when tomorrow comes, all of our good intentions go out the window. So this generally happens. Bhaktivinoda Thakur also writes some wonderful songs, as does Sankaracharya. Sankaracharya and Bhajagovinda, he also writes of this, how we're going again and again in these wombs of a mother and then taking birth and again engaging in materialistic activities and going through the cycle again and again and again. And we're going through the cycle based just on our material desires as evidenced by our material actions. Oh, my. All right, so what's happening with Maharaj Parikshit here is a little different. It's a little different. First of all, he's such a great hero that his personality is evidenced even in the womb. Of course, that's true for all of us, you know, the big nature-nurture debate. So all of us come into this life with our subtle body that's developed from previous life. And Maharaj Parikshit is an example, an extreme example of Kshatriya. He's meant to be the world emperor. And he's such a hero that when he's attacked with the Brahmastra in the womb, he's able to tolerate it. Unbelievable. Right? This is, of course, how Parasaram knew that Karna was not a brahmana, because he was able to tolerate the biting of a terrible insect while his guru was sleeping on his lap. But But the other wonderful thing that happens to Maharishi Parikshit is that when he's in danger in the womb, the Lord himself enters the womb. Of course, the Lord is everywhere, but he manifests himself personally to save the boy. He neutralizes the Brahmastra in Uttara's womb. And Parikshit was called Parikshit, which means the inquirer, because after his birth, he was constantly searching. Where is that person? Where is that person? Where is that person? So Maharishi Parikshit, although on one level, he's going through this process of being in the womb and taking birth like anyone else, what's really happening is that he is part of the Lord's Leela, even from within the womb. It's not that Maharishi Parikshit is just taking birth due to his desires and karma, entangled in the modes of material nature, karma guna sangasya sadasad janma yonishu, one is born from a womb according to the association of the modes of nature. But no, Maharishi Parikshit is doing this to take part in the Lord's story. And this can happen from any point. We should not think, oh, well, you've got to be a Nitya Siddha, a pure devotee from the womb in order to be part of the Lord's Leela. No, the Lord's pastimes, Bhaktivedanta Thakur explains in Jiva Dharma, that this whole material world is the Lord's pastime. And at any point, we can decide that we're going to join. So just like here, Prabhupada said he developed his desired body. So our desire can also propel us, rather than into a material situation, into a spiritual situation. In fact, as Krishna explains in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the whole purpose of performing yoga, abhyas yoga, practice yoga, is to develop ichha, or desire, that is spiritual. Well, as we develop a desire that is spiritual, then our life in this world, even though from a superficial point of view, it appears that also we're dying and we're in a womb and we're taking birth and we're going to school and we're going to a job and whatever we're doing. Although it appears like that superficially, actually what's going on is that we're part of the Lord's transcendental pastime. So it's always true that this material world is one of the Lord's pastimes. It's always true that the Lord is present in our heart, and therefore it's always true that a conditioned soul can choose to cultivate desires to engage in the Lord's pastimes rather than in this cycle of birth and death. But this is especially true at the present time. It's always true, but perhaps we could say that it's particularly easy to access that truth at the present time. So it's always there, but for most of the time, it's something that's hard for a conditioned soul to get in touch with. At the present time, however, because of Mahaprabhu's appearing just about 500 years ago and spreading his Sankirtan movement, it's entirely possible to have a life that's fully within the Lord's Leela at the present time for anybody. And such an easy way, the essence of participating in the Lord's Leela is Sankirtan, congregational chanting of the holy name of the Lord, which if you compare Mahaprabhu's Leela and Krishna Leela, that this is particularly done at the times of the day when Krishna is meeting with the gopis. So this Ras Leela pastime that Krishna manifests, wherein he's dancing not only with his eternal gopis, but he's also bringing into the circle of the Ras Mandala those jivas who have become perfect through practice yoga, like the Munichari gopis. So in the same way, Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan, yeah, some of his Sankirtan is at Srivasa's house, that's very private, but his Sankirtan on the street, that is to bring in the conditioned souls and bring them up to the level of their constitutional position. So when we engage in the Sankirtan movement, primarily through group singing of the Hare Krishna mantra, but also through writing, printing, and distribution of literatures, through distribution of sanctified foodstuff, prasada, and any way in which we are trying to bring people into the circle of Krishna's enjoyment. Prabhupada said the purpose of the Hare Krishna movement is to join this pleasure dance of Krishna. So any way in which we are trying to bring living entities back to their pleasurable relationship with Krishna, then we also are entering into the Lord's Leela. And one who is fully conscious of this is praying like Mahaprabhu, Nadanam Nadanam Nasundarin Kavitamba Jagadisha Kamaye Mama Janmani Janmani Shure Bhavatad Bhakti Ohoitiki Chaye. So one who sees this, they don't care about repeated birth and death. I mean, Krishna says, Mamupecha Punar Janma Naiti Mameti Sorjuna. He says, they come to me. Svakvadeham Punar Janma. Naiti Mameti Sorjuna. After giving up the body, Arjuna, they don't take birth again. They come to me. But the pure devotees, they don't even care if they take birth again. You know, for the beginning devotees, as Krishna says, those who want to get free of birth, death, old age, and disease, they also take to Krishna consciousness. For the beginning devotees, that may be the motivation. Oh, let me get out of here and go back to my home. You know, kind of, you left home hoping to find your fortune, and you ended up instead in a bad neighborhood with broken windows and thieves, and you're sick and you're hungry and you haven't even found a place to sleep and take a shower, and you're like, I just want to go home. So that may be a mentality, you know, in the beginning. But as a devotee relishes Krishna's service and sees that Krishna's service is also present here, it doesn't really matter. Like Gopa Kumar in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, he's explaining that sometimes he's in the spiritual world with Krishna, and sometimes he's in the material world with Krishna, and he only notices the difference in the coming and going. He's a commuter. And also Gopa Kumar is given the instruction by Srimati Radharani, hey, I've got this Brahmin there who's my devotee, which is interesting because the Brahmin has started out worshipping a material demigoddess, and you please help him to come home to me. So for the pure devotee, it doesn't matter. The pure devotee's time in the womb is not troublesome, or even being burned by this brahmastra. You know, we might think, well, why did the pure devotees going through this horrible? Why does Krishna let him be burned by this brahmastra? You know, Krishna has interesting ways of doing his lulas. Krishna could just have neutralized the brahmastra before he even went in the womb, and Maharaj Parikshit would have felt nothing, and Maharaj Parikshit wouldn't even know what had taken place. So what would be better, to have Krishna save you when you don't even know about it, or to experience some burning which you're able to tolerate and see that Krishna's there to save you? I mean, what would you rather? So suppose right now Krishna's saving you from some catastrophe that you don't even know about, and you don't know the catastrophe was coming, and you don't know that Krishna saved you. Or would you like to have the catastrophe right in your face, have the strength to not have it affect you, and have Krishna come personally right in front of your face and save you from the catastrophe? I mean, what would be more fun? So Krishna loves to do it the second way, and he does it that way over and over and over again. You know, Vyomasura takes the cowherd boys and puts them in a cave, and Krishna goes there and rescues them. Now, why does Krishna let Vyomasura put the cowherd boys in a cave at all? You know, why doesn't he just knock out Vyomasura before he does anything? Indra's sending floods. Now, right now, as we speak, the people on the east coast of America, many of them are in severe flooding from Hurricane Irene. So Indra was sending such a flood. It says in the Bhagavatam, you couldn't tell higher land from lower land. And then Krishna saves them by lifting Govardhan Hill. I mean, again, what would you rather? So there you are in Vrindavan. And Indra's really angry, and Krishna just neutralizes Indra, and Indra doesn't get a chance to do anything. And you don't even know, you're going about your business, you don't even know that Indra was angry or anything. He just takes care of it in the background. Or would you rather that there's this big flood and you can't even tell higher land and lower land, and the rain is falling like sharp piercing arrows, and you're shivering from the cold, and Krishna lifts this mountain for a week. And you get to be under the mountain for a week with Krishna while it's raining outside. And then you come out from under the mountain and everything is restored. I mean, what would be more fun? Or, you know, the cowherd boys are busy playing in Bandiravan, and they're so busy playing they don't notice the cows and the buffalo and the goats that they're supposed to be taking care of, that they cross the Yamuna and they start going to the Chichivan, what's it called, forest, where they get stuck in sugarcane. And they get surrounded by a forest fire, and the boys have to... They're worried, oh, I abandoned my service, and they're out looking for their animals. finally they find the trail and they follow them and they come to the animals and they rescue the animals. And then the forest fire, which had been far away, quickly comes with the wind as a chariot driver and surrounds them in all eight directions. Krishna, Krishna, you know. And Krishna says, close your eyes. And he swallows up the fire. When they open their eyes, they're back in Bandiravan, 15 kilometers away. Now, what's more fun, that or having the cows never wander off? So Krishna loves to do these kinds of activities because Krishna is Ananda. He's full of bliss. And what's bliss? Bliss is some adventure, some story. And what's a story? A story has to have a conflict. Otherwise, it's not a story. You know, go back to English 101. There has to be some problem that's surmounted. So even in the spiritual world, there's apparent problems. The gopis are married to someone else, and their mothers-in-law and fathers-in-law don't want them to leave. They have to sneak out in the middle of the night. So that's what's fun. So sometimes we think, all right, the way to be a spiritual person, the way to get rid of my material desires and stop taking birth over and over and over again, is just peace. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. And everything should just be peaceful, beautiful. Like lying on my back on an inner tube or a floaty in the peaceful water with the sun shining and no worries and cares. But how long are you going to stay like that? And is that really ultimate fun? I mean, that may be relief, but is that really what we want? Don't we like adventure and relationships and mystery and excitement and people getting saved at the last minute in some wonderful, miraculous way? So we can see, if we choose, we can see that even the so-called difficulties and obstacles in our life are just opportunities for Krishna to save us. Just reading this most wonderful article submitted to Back to Godhead about one devotee in India who slipped on a wet floor and ended up with some severe injuries. He ended up with a cracked vertebrae, and it's quite severe. And his, I think, a broken hip, young man. And the pain was terrible. And he thought, what am I going to do for this pain? So he had memorized the Bhagavad Gita, memorized pretty much all 700 verses in order. And so he just started reciting the Bhagavad Gita. And he was writing that as soon as he was reciting the Bhagavad Gita, he started meditating on the meaning of the verses. And as he was doing that, the pain receded. And as soon as he would stop, the pain would come back. So he just kept focusing on that, on the Bhagavad Gita. He said when he got to the hospital, the doctors were just astonished. They said, you know, anybody else with these injuries would be screaming in pain. And this devotee gained so much faith from this experience and so much appreciation for Krishna and a determination to go to that state of absorption, not just out of necessity, but out of love. So what this devotee saw was how Krishna was involved in his life, how Krishna had used this catastrophe in order to bring this devotee to the point that he wanted to get to, of this loving relationship with Krishna. So if one sees everything in one's life like that, then actually it's not painful or difficult. Krishna will give us the ability, as he's giving here to Maharishit, to tolerate the pain, or not even to notice it, to endure it, or to be practically unaware of it, and to have our relationship with Krishna. Therefore, Krunti is playing Tatrik Tatra Jagat Guru. Krishna, please come and reciprocate with me. And if to do that means that I'm going to go through, crises, and then bring them on, anything so I can have this reciprocation with you. I don't care what the circumstances are. And the devotee who goes like that, they're not experiencing the material world, like it says in Bhagavatam, like a very intoxicated person. They don't even know if they have clothes on or not. And as Krishna said, as Prabhupada says in the purport to Bhagavad Gita 12:20, then all the material things are just taken care of automatically. One doesn't even have to be aware of them. So we can start even on a beginning platform. What sort of environment am I creating for myself to live in? How am I using my energies? I have a certain amount of energy. I have a certain kind of energy. Whatever it is, it is. I'm not going to, in this lifetime, drastically change the kind or, frankly, even the amount that I'm coming in with. But I can certainly change how I use it. What do I use it for? Do I use it to build an environment where in this life I'm suffering and then I have to go to Yamaraj and I have to be put in a womb and I have to go on and on and on again and again and again and again? Or am I using the amount and kind of energy I have? Doesn't matter how much energy I have. It doesn't matter what kind of energy I have. It matters what I use it for. If I'm thinking, I wish I had more energy, or I wish I had a different kind of energy, then I just take another body. So I can try to experience that. Whatever amount I have, whatever kind I have, if I use that to see, okay, how is Krishna acting in my life? How is what's happening to me really Krishna? As we said before, Maharaj Parikshit saw the curse of the Brahmana as Krishna having taken that form. He saw, oh, Krishna's come in the form of a Brahmin's curse. So we can see that all these things that happen to us, it doesn't matter why they happen to us. It doesn't matter, is this, because I get this question all the time, is this bad thing happening to me or this good thing happening to me because of my own karma and desires or because it's what Krishna desires? Ultimately, once you surrender to Krishna, whatever happens to you is because Krishna desires. Even if the situation that we're in, I mean, altogether, I wouldn't even be in this material world if it wasn't for my own karma and my own desires. So certainly, it's my own karma and my own desires. Once I surrender to Krishna, one can see everything. That Krishna is allowing this to happen. He's sanctioning this to happen. He wants this to happen. Why? He wants this to happen simply so that he can become my hero. Krishna loves playing the hero. You know, here Maharaj Parikshit is described as Veera, as the hero. But Krishna is the biggest Veera, right? Prabhupada named one devotee Veera Krishna. So Krishna loves to play the hero. He loves to save his devotee. He loves to have these loving relationships with the devotee. And if we think like that, if we meditate like that, then there's no question of this death and rebirth materially. We can choose then to take birth again in order to engage with Krishna's pastimes here, or we can choose not to, to be in Goloka and engage in Krishna's pastimes there, or both. And we are then free of the grip of the modes of material nature. And everything then becomes joyful. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma, the Sochitina consciousness. So I am a little tight this morning. Maybe we could take questions for about 10 minutes. So if anybody has it.
Okay, Prabhus, if you'd like to ask any questions or comments, those on free conferencing, you can mute and unmute yourself with star 6. You're unmuted right now. Anyone have a question or comment?
I have a question.
Yes, please. Yes, okay. Please go ahead.
Irmala Devi, do any of the devotees, you have a long standing relationship with a lot of the leading devotees in the movement. Do any of the devotees feel that they're beyond karma and beyond the modes of material nature?
Yes. Although they're not gonna, they're not generally going to say that publicly, but yes, definitely. And that's true not just for leading devotees, but for little devotees. So I know of some little background devotees. I know of one lady who basically gives a few Bhagavatam classes and makes garlands for the deities. She's a cancer survivor, and that's about all that she can do. She's not known at all outside of the place where she lives. And she feels very much that she's beyond the modes of material nature. And, I mean, how can you judge someone else's position? But at least from the external behavior, we would not doubt it. And right. then I also know some big leaders and sannyasis who will indicate like that sometimes. Depends what mood you catch them in. You know, sometimes you might catch them in a mood where they say, you know, I'm just a totally fallen conditioned soul, the lowest of the low, and I'm fully under the grip of the modes of material nature. And then other times you'll catch them where they're like, wow, it is so wonderful. Like that book, Simple for the Simple, where, what was her name? She was dying of a brain tumor. And at one point her husband said to her, it must be nice to be a liberated soul. And she said, yes, it is. So, you know, that it depends sometimes on the mood. Like even Vasudeva, Krishna's father, says that he was astonished that an ordinary conditioned soul like him could have Krishna for a son. So it's sort of the, I see this dichotomy as exemplified by Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, when he says, my dear Lord, from your mercy, you've turned a crow into Garuda. So if he focuses on himself, he sees himself as a crow. If he focuses on Mahaprabhu's mercy, then he sees himself like Garuda. So if the devotee who is liberated focuses on themselves, they see, oh, I'm a fallen conditioned soul. If they focus on the mercy of Guru, then they see, oh, I'm a liberated soul beyond the modes of material nature. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I do certainly know of people, and certainly not confined to leaders, the people I know of who feel that they are above the modes of nature and whose activities tend to incline you to believe them. Some of them are not known well at all. Some of them have some de facto leadership in a small area without any kind of position. And some of them are big leaders. Most of the people I know like that are renunciates, but I also know some married persons like that, married with children and the whole thing, who are in that position and who are, as I say, starting to exhibit the symptoms that Mahaprabhu tells to Sanatana Goswami. You know, we can't. Of course, the only person's consciousness we can judge is our own, and even that, if we're on a low platform, we may not be able to judge it very well. So it's not that we're going to testify to somebody else. Does that answer your question? I wasn't exactly sure what you're
saying. Yeah, that's okay.
Risham, Dave, you had a question?
Yes, please. I just Amala, thank you for another very lucid presentation of the philosophy. Yeah, it's very, very, very enlightening. I was wondering, you know, we have lots of information about Krishna Loka, that Krishna engages in pastimes and all sorts of things with his devotees, and you say he loves things like that. We know that there are so many Vaikuntha planets as well, and apart from, say, maybe the planet of Lord Ramachandra, we don't seem to have much information about how the devotees worship and what actually goes on those planets. Do you know if there's some information about what actually happens, because how do they spend their time in awe and reverence?
I've also wondered that. So there is a description in Bhagavatam, especially in the third canto, description of the kingdom of God, where the activities of Vaikuntha are described. But it's very general. So it describes as, you know, cities with parks. There's some description also in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. I'd say that there's probably more description in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita when Gopakumar goes to Vaikuntha. And it appears to be just a city with airplanes and parks, and that with the Lord there, the Lord and Lakshmi there as a supreme king and queen, and people engaging in just pleasurable activities. So from those, I would guess that it's, you know, people don't have to go to work. But what are the kind of things people do in cities? If they don't have to go to work, they go to the park, they go to the theater, they clean their houses, they cook, but with everything with the Lord as the center. So that they see that they're very, everything is devoted to the Lord, and they're living a life of great opulence. And that's about as far as we can get from what we have in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita and what we have in the Bhagavatam. There might be other places where there's more descriptions. You know, there's a lot of other Puranas, I'm not familiar with them, where there might be more detailed descriptions. I mean, we also know that there's each Vaikuntha planet has a somewhat different form of the Lord, like Mahaprabhu describes that each form of the Lord in the different Vaikuntha planets has the four items placed in different places in their hands. And now we would, again, it would be reasonable to understand that each of these forms is manifesting a slightly different personality. Otherwise, why so many planets? So on each of these Vaikuntha planets, there must be some differences in one planet and another. And the different activities that take place. So that's about all we have. And, you know, again, there might be more in other Shastras, or you might find more from other Sampradayas. For example, the Sri Sampradaya, their focus is on Vaikuntha. So they might have more descriptions of the activities there. And since Raghunath Das Goswami in Manushiksha, I believe in text 4, specifically advises us not to become attached to Lord Narayana. And in 1865, a Bhagavad Gita purport, Prabhupada says not to divert our attention to these other Vishnu forms. And that might be one reason why, particularly in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, there is a paucity of information about Vaikuntha. Because when Prabhupada talks about in the 8th chapter of the Gita, when Krishna is speaking in a very gentle way about the spiritual sky, you know, that we don't need any sun or moon or electricity. And there Prabhupada says we should become captivated by this information. And in the same way, we want to become captivated by the descriptions of Goloka Vrindavan. So I think, you know, if there's detailed descriptions of Vaikuntha, we might become captivated by that. And that we're really being urged to go to Goloka Vrindavan and not to be sort of sidetracked by devotion to the Narayana features. Because for most of us, that's not going to give us our ultimate satisfaction. But you can look in those two places. Look in the third canto, Bhagavatam description. I think it's in the third canto. Description of the kingdom of God. Actually, I can look it right up here on my computer for you. See exactly where it is. It's a... That is Canto 3, Chapter 15, Description of the Kingdom of God. You can also get some little idea from these descriptions of Dwarka that we just read through. I mean, although Dwarka is part of the Goloka Vrindavan planet, it's going to have something, some similarities of what kind of things that people are doing. And then again, as I said, in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, there's a whole section where Gopakumar is in Vaikuntha. Not nearly as detailed as, say, what the Goswamis give us of Goloka, but it's definitely there.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, sir, thank you very much. I just wanted to pick your brains on this plan, you see, so I'll look up the reference. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mother Ermila, if you have time for one more question, mine is a little bit complicated. If you got to go, then I'll hold it.
I'll go ahead.
This verse in particular, it's a little bit different in the description about Maharaj Parikshit. He's there in the womb and he's tolerating the heat instead of leaving his body, whereas normally anyone else would just leave their body. Srila Prabhupada, many, many times, hundreds, thousands of times, he's always he quotes this verse, you know, that we're forced to leave. But of course we have descriptions about like Bhishma and yogis, even Hiranyakashipu, he kept his life airs within his bones. You know, there's that book by Viktor Frankl and Search for Meaning. He relates there that the people in the concentration camps that he was in, that even if they wanted to get revenge for the guards, the cruelty that was enough of a desire that they would survive. So I wanted just to read something quickly. It's like four or five sentences. This is a lecture Prabhupada gave in May of 73 on the Bhagavatam in New York. He says that generally at the time of death, the whole system becomes disarranged with kapha pitta vayu. They are coughing, there's headaches, there's some pain in the general system. Sometimes they are so intolerable that a man who is going to die, he cries. The system within the body is so complicated that any time it is disarranged, it becomes a great source of pain. So at the time of death means the arrangement becomes so dangerously painful that one leaves his body. No more, this is death. This bodily arrangement is so painful, just like one commits suicide. When the situation is too much painful, he wants to be rescued by committing suicide. Similarly, when the bodily pains are too severe, then the living entity cannot live in this body. Chakva deham, he gives up this body, so we have to give up this body that we forget. So my question is, at the moment of death, are we talking about two different things here, or is it universal that what happens is that the bodily constitution becomes so painful that the living entity himself wants to leave, or is it that we're just all forced out?
Those are not two different things.
Okay, I'm all ears.
Okay, so think about some time in your life. You were living someplace, you were doing something, and the situation started to get difficult. So you tried to adjust it this way, that way, the other way. Your adjustments maybe worked a little bit, or maybe they worked for a little bit of time, but still it got difficult. And then it got really difficult, and then it got really difficult. And finally, it reached a point that you said, I'm done. I'm not going to try to fix this situation anymore. I'm not going to try to tolerate it anymore. This situation is not favorable for me anymore. I can't function in it. I'm out of here. And you leave.
Okay.
In fact, I just did that yesterday. I was working with a project, and the circumstances of it were just intolerable for me. I called the head of the project and I said, you know, I'm ready to resign. But if you want me to stay, this is what I need. And the head of the project said, I'm not willing to give you what you need. And I said, then I'm gone. That doesn't mean it was easy to go. I was kind of painful to go.
Mother.
So who's arranging that our situation is so painful that we have to go? That's a kind of force. I mean, of course, it depends on your strength. So if you're sitting on a chair on the floor right now, suppose where you were. Oh, Prabhupada tells the story of the fire. So he tells the story, this king was only going to give free food to lazy people. And so they brought together everyone in the kingdom who said they were lazy. And then the king instructed his ministers, now set the building on fire. And everybody leaves, and then two guys are just like rolling over to try to get away from the heat. And the king said, these guys are actually lazy. So if your building's on fire, that's a kind of forcing to leave the building.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of forcing. Now, there may ultimately be some sort of forcing where the Yamadutas come and pull you out. Even if you're saying, I'm determined to stay in this body longer, and they say, sorry. You know, so is it just that if it's time to be evicted from your house, that Krishna or his servants start burning your house down? And you've got to run out of the building? Just reaches a point where you just run out of the building?
Mm-hmm.
Or do some people leave as soon as they get a little bit of an eviction notice? I mean, you just get the notice, okay, your house is going to be burnt down in a week. Some people pack up and leave then. Some people wait until it's a roaring fire. Some people stay in the house a little longer. If what your question is how much control do we have over when we die, I'd say that's a very individual thing.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the essence of your question.
Well, more like, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, it's more like it would appear in this description here, and what you've just said is that actually it comes to the point that the spirit soul comes to the point. He just doesn't want to stay in this body anymore.
Oh, Mother Urmila, can I say something? This is Radha.
Oh,
Hare Krishna. I have nothing to say about Shastra, but working in a old folks home for 4 years, I took care of very old people up to 102 was my oldest one that I took care of, and I watched them. And even if you bathe them so gently, or if you change their sheets every day and took very good care of them, every day there was a common theme whenever I would go into certain individuals' rooms, and it would be, they would say this, they say, mo beta make, and that's Pidgin Hawaiian for, it's better to be dead. I'd rather be dead. I want to leave my body. And they would explain to me how horrible. I mean, we can't even imagine, because they would explain what type of life they used to have and then what they don't have control over anymore. And it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. And that they, to the point where they're saying, I would rather be gone from this. I need something different. So it seems like I watched that there are people that are willing to go. They want to go. They're ready to give up the body. And I also worked with dialysis patients on, you know, kidney failure, and watched that happen. So that's like a disease. And a lot of times, I had one lady, and she was only 40-something years old, and I was taking care of her, and she said, tomorrow I'm stopping my kidney machine. And I said, why? And she says, I just don't want my husband to suffer anymore and come to visit me here in old folks' home, and I'm only 45, and I want to go, and I'm done with this. And sure enough, she stopped, and in a few days she was gone. And the only thing is like, I don't know what it's like to watch somebody in an accident, but I've seen all kinds of deaths. You know, so that's all I can say. And as far as the babies, yes, they do get bitten and everything. But one horrible thing that I don't think a lot of people don't know is a lot of babies swallow their own stool, and that could be life-threatening to them. So that's pretty horrible.
In the womb, you're saying?
Yes, in the womb. So they have to be suctioned and revived, right, and everything when they come out.
Right. I mean, the way looking at this situation from what we practically experience with death and these things that Srila Prabhupada's saying, again, I just see in this life, if Krishna feels, or the universal governors feel, okay, this person now needs to move on. I mean, gosh, even with the children here, my 4-year-old grandson, he put on a pair of pants the other day, and it was too short. And his mother said, those pants don't fit you anymore. So she said, you can't wear them. We're going out today. I'm not going to take you out in pants that short. You know, you need to get some new pants. So is he willingly going to take them off, or do they have to be, you know, forcibly taken off of him? I mean, in his case, he willingly took them off. So I think that it seems that some living entities, when they get notice, you know, that your body's falling apart, they say, okay, I'm going to go. They're not going to wait until it becomes intolerable. And for other people, they have, you know, they get wait and wait and wait until it becomes intolerable, and then they leave, or even then they may have to be pulled out of their body. And it's really interesting what you say about these old people who are suffering and say they want to die.
Yeah.
I'm just, again, thinking about what I recently went through. I was working on this project, and I say that I've been very unhappy with this project since February. It hasn't been run in a way that I could work with. I mean, I loved all the people with it, but it just was a series of frustrations and disappointments and confusions and miscommunications and just one problem after another after another. And I would go to different people and say, I really want to quit working for this project, but I wouldn't actually quit. There was still a part of me that thought, well, maybe we can work it out. It's worthwhile. It's good people. And then I give it another try. And then I go, I really want to quit this project.
And it took me a long time before I just finally said, this is hopeless. There's nothing I can do to fix this situation. My energies are better spent elsewhere. And even then, writing the letter to the devotees saying I'm dropping out of the project was extremely difficult. I wrote it. I just stared at it on my screen for 5 minutes. And then I had to walk away from my computer and then come back and finally, like, oh, okay, I'm going to push the send button. So I think a lot of times with death, it's like that too. You know, the body's broken down. It's useless. And the person's saying, I just want to die. But when it comes down to it, they're not ready to die. They still have some fear of the unknown. Well, what will happen if I die? Where will I go? Maybe I can do something in this body. And so they continue to hang on and continue to hang on. And finally it gets to the point where it's just, oh, okay, I got to go. And it just gets too intense. So I see that goes on even in this life when we go through all the
changes,
all the hundreds or thousands of little deaths that we go through in this life. Of leaving one situation, letting go of something that's painful and not working, and being willing to forge a new identity. And that may have been preceded by a long time of thinking, I'm not happy in this situation. I've really got to make a change before we really get the courage and the determination, which may come from the situation becoming completely unbearable, or it may come from our own conviction. I think that's personal. Okay, I do have to go now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mother Irmela.
Just a wonderful.
Thank you, Mother Irmela.
Thank you very much.
I greatly appreciate this, Sangha.
Hi, Uncle Isha Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.
Jai.
Hi, Bhagavatam.
Hare Krishna.